Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with authors, filmmakers, and historians, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is William Giroux. He is an author, historian, former journalist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and he's also the author of today's book, The 15, Murder, Retribution, and the Forgotten Story of Nazi POWs in America. William, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be here.
This is like something that people do not know about at all. Nazis in America during World War II. So that's basically what your book's about. Can you tell us a little bit about how many of those were in America, maybe?
We had, I'd say, almost 400,000, but it was about 370,000 plus, which translated to, it's really about four armies worth of captured German soldiers, or that an amount that would, as I mentioned in the book, that would equal the 1940s population of Denver or Seattle. So it was a lot of German POWs.
Wow. Well, people would probably be surprised to know that we had Nazis in America.
I think they would. People would know typically if you put a camp in a community, the people around there would know about it because for one thing, they'd be aware of it. And the Germans would be, who could be compelled to work, would be working on local farms. But most people, I don't think, had any notion of exactly how many there were or how vast this network of German POW camps was.
Even reading your book, it was pretty shocking, some of the things that I learned that we'll get into in a minute. I wanted to ask you real quick, first thing that comes up when we think about POW camps, especially in the last 100 years or so, or last 80 years or so, the Geneva Conventions, where we think of, one of the things you mentioned was that the Geneva Convention said that officers had to be treated the same as regular soldiers and that we took it like super seriously in America. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, according to the Geneva Convention, which we followed to the letter as best we could, required that the POWs live in basically the same conditions as American soldiers who were on the home front. And in practice, that meant, comfortable, not somewhat Spartan, but comfortable beds and plenty of good food, all sorts of recreational opportunities ranging from, taking college level classes to, and they could play soccer. They had libraries. They could go to movies. They had arts and crafts. And some of these
arts
guys were, did landscape painting and made sculptures and put on plays. So it was quite elaborate. A lot of critics in the United States, particularly families that had loved ones who had fought and died in the war in Europe, were just appalled that we would treat a ruthless enemy like this. And their nickname for, they constantly complained that we were coddling these Germans, and their term for the system of camps was the Fritz Ritz.
That's a pretty good name for it, considering the conditions. It sounds like it would almost be tempting to purposefully be captured so that you could be in an American POW instead of on the front, or in the camp instead of on the front lines. Unless, would you be risking maybe you end up going to a Russian one, and that's not so good?
Yeah, if you could survive being captured by the Russians. It was a lot of, humane treatment of POWs was, as I point out in the book, was not a given during World War II, and particularly on the Eastern Front, the Germans and the Soviets were routinely just murdered and enslaved each other's prisoners. So it was very not unusual, because on the Western Front, where we fought the Germans and the British and the Canadians did, the Germans, at least at the beginning of the war, made an effort to follow the Geneva Convention. Their camps were not nearly as nice as the ones in the United States, but they basically provided food. But as the war went on and Germany became gotten worse and worse shape, the conditions in the camps deteriorated. The food became, was crummy, and the treatment, the Germans became frustrated, and it got worse and worse as the war progressed.
Yeah, it's definitely the picture that stays in your mind when you think of POW camps in Germany. It's not very nice. I mean, probably the worst were in Russia. But I feel like it's a testament to American values, the fact that not only did we follow the Geneva Convention, we took it so seriously, where we were actually overturning convictions of Nazis because their rights had been violated during interrogation. Is that right?
We tried very hard to the view of the American leadership from FDR down was that it was treating prisoners humanely was the American way. It was the right thing to do. And we at that time wanted to be the light of the world, an example of to the other nations. We wanted to be a leader. So we felt like this was what we needed to do. But of course, there was also a selfish side to it, that if you treated the enemy well, the captured enemy well, you would hope that the enemy would reciprocate and treat captured American soldiers well. And that was very much a part of our consideration. So it was a mixture of the altruistic and the selfish but we felt like this was, so it was really a combination of the two. It was something we felt we as Americans had to do, but we also wanted to protect our guys as best we could.
That makes sense. You see that over the centuries in warfare, trying to prevent this escalation of how to treat your prisoners and things like that in war. It reminds me of that, I think it's a Thomas Jefferson quote that's like, the rights, I mean, I think he was talking about the constitutional rights, but the idea is just general human rights that apply to everyone, everywhere, under every circumstance. There's a quote that goes along something like that. And I feel like this was a real test of that, like literal actual Nazis during World War II. And we were like, we're going to make sure you're treated humanely. That's a pretty big test of that idea.
Yeah. Some people felt that the Geneva Convention, which this version of it was written in 1929, some people felt that this was sort of a romantic, outdated relic of when war was a contest waged by gentlemen. I'm not sure that was ever really true, but some people thought the Geneva Convention was outdated and that we should not really feel obligated to do this, particularly as the war went on and more evidence developed of what the Nazis were capable of, not so much to our prisoners of war, but just in general. And there was a sense that, okay, they're treating our guys right now, they're trying to follow the Geneva Convention. But what happens when Hitler inevitably is backed up against the wall? We knew what it was clear by then, what sort of guy he was and what he was capable of. So there's very much a concern as the war went on of, was this treatment of American POWs likely to continue, or was it going to be turned into a mass slaughter at the end?
And there was an effort at the end, at least in Germany, to kind of just, we're going to kill everybody in our camps. Did you come across any sort of diaries or correspondence or anything like that of American POWs in Germany being held at the end of the war, afraid of being just wiped out, just being annihilated as they tried to hide everything?
Yes, a lot of the POWs, because they really, the vast majority of the American POWs came home, survived the war and came home. So a lot of them wrote about their experiences, and I accessed it. There are all sorts of sources for these books and documents and official reports. There, thousands of them, really. So you get, if you read enough of them, you get a pretty good picture of what it was like for these guys and how, as the war went on, their worry and the conditions in the camps in Germany worsened, that how much more they were concerned that they were going to end up, so one day an order was going to come down for the SS to come in and just shoot everybody. So there's very much a concern by the Americans, even when they were being treated reasonably well, that this was, this could suddenly change.
I can imagine, especially because the SS had such a reputation for just doing that just for kicks, even without trying to hide anything, just slaughtering and murdering people. So that would be terrifying. What would you say if the war had actually been on our soil in America? Do you think that we would have also kind of disintegrated our standards of how we treat POWs?
That's a possible question to answer, of course, but I think the chances are pretty good. I think there were times in this, as I describe in this book, where the violence in some of the camps was kind of spiraling and prisoners were being murdered, that we suddenly felt that we had thought the camp, everything seemed to be going just, you know, pretty well with the camps. The prisoners were working, the escapes were not proving to be a problem. There was no sabotage, but there was a sense that this might, you know, that this might go sideways.
Sure. Yeah. So escaping wasn't really a huge problem, but I have to know more about this story that you mentioned in your book about this Nazi who escaped into the mainland of America and he got caught because of Jim Crow laws. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, that happened to several of them, and probably more than are in the records have kept. But a couple of, one guy in particular, it wasn't that hard to escape to walk away from a lot of these camps. You know, during the day, the prisoners would go out on these work details on farms and factories, and it wasn't that difficult to walk away from one of those. You could do that pretty easily. But the problem was what after that. You know, if you were in Europe and you escaped from a POW camp in Germany, you had a puncher's chance, really, of falling in with a resistance group or finding your way across the border to Sweden or Switzerland. But in America, you had, you know, once you got out of a camp, you were a hunted man, and you had to go hundreds or thousands of miles just to get to the ocean and then find a way across. So it was extremely difficult. And the example you cite, there were in the South, we had the Jim Crow laws, and the Germans were completely unfamiliar with these. And one guy escaped, walked away from a camp and thought he was going to get away, but he sat in the bus under a sign that said whites only, the sign that he couldn't read. And people immediately recognized that he was not, you're not from here, are you? So other Germans had the same experience on riverboats. And so they would just get caught up in the workings of Jim Crow. And in some cases, I point out in the book a couple of examples that the black American soldiers who were in the South had to eat. They couldn't eat in restaurants and dining rooms. Mm. They were consigned to the kitchen. But the Germans, who were white, when they were in transit, like in a train station, they could eat in the dining room, and they would sit there and eat and drink. And there was one classic letter written by an American soldier who was found himself consigned to the dining room, a black American soldier in uniform, consigned to the kitchen eating while he looked out and saw these Germans sitting out who were allowed into the dining room. So it's just hard to imagine.
Very hard. I can't believe that these Nazis escaped POW camps in America and they're caught because they don't understand Jim Crow laws. Like, you can't sit in the back of the bus. That's for black people only. That's wild.
Yeah. The Germans they often took note of this, you know, that they saw what was happening in the South, and they would, you know, they would throw it in the face of interrogators. You know, where's your democracy? What are you doing? And of course, the soldiers of Nazi Germany were in no position to lecture anybody on racial discrimination, but they weren't blind.
And they weren't pretending that they weren't out there going, we're this free land, this democracy. They're like, we know what you are, and you're out in the open. And America's like, we're this democracy, but we've got Jim Crow. So that's hypocritical. So these Nazis were actually waking up in the day. So they're prisoners of war. They're in America and they're having breakfast with farmers' families that they're working on the farms for and playing with their kids. And what? Did that happen over in Europe, let's say, like in the French POW camps? Were they playing games and farming?
No, it didn't happen over there, and it didn't happen in Britain. But it was just a different dynamic here. For one thing, a lot of the Germans were such a valuable labor force in the United States. They could be compelled to work. The enlisted men, and they could be compelled to work. And they filled a huge need, because millions of American workers had left farms and factories to either to join the military or to go to work at the defense plants, which were booming and which paid better. So a lot of these farm families and just a lot of people in the United States were just grateful to have these Germans there. And the Germans, at least on the surface, they worked hard, they were polite, they were, one farmer noted, they looked like us. And they were particularly in some German-American communities in the Midwest, the Germans were often welcomed like sort of like distant relatives who'd made bad life decisions, and they became very close to these families. And there is an example, I can't remember if I put this in a book, but one woman described a heavily muscled SS man rescuing her baby sister from a charging bull. Another guy talked about his son after a day's work in the fields on the shoulders of a German, returning home, who was playfully goose-stepping with the little boy giggling on his shoulders. And it was, then the farm families would insist that the German prisoners and their guards join them from around the table for a family dinner, which was a gross violation of regulations. But, what are you going to do? Yeah. You're out in the middle of Kansas and the mother wants you to come to dinner. What are you going to do? So there were a lot of scenes like that where it wasn't just in the Midwest. They were welcome just because they were so valuable, and they were saving some of these businesses and farms from really hard times.
Wow. Did any of the farmers ever, or the family members ever, express any sort of moral issues with we're getting close to Nazis. Yeah, we need them on our farms, but I wish we didn't.
Yes, there was a certain amount of opposition to this in the United States. And again, particularly among families who had loved ones fighting in Europe. And they just said, why are we bringing Nazis into to work in our fields? And there's some very poignant writings by children who said, my parents thought this was a great thing, but I was always scared of these guys. I never went anywhere near them. And there were efforts to persuade the governing bodies these camps were so popular that when there was a new one proposed, the communities, politicians, and Chamber of Commerce would lobby for it, as like they would lobbying for a new bridge or a new highway. But this was something that a lot of communities actively sought, please, U.S. Army, build a POW camp around us because we really need it. And there was opposition, and some people would write in and say, can't we just work a little harder and just not have these guys in here? But the economic need usually won the day.
What do you think soldiers fighting on the front lines, fighting Nazis, seeing all the horrors of war, what do you think they would think if they had known, or maybe they did know, about how comfortably some of these German prisoners were living in the U.S.?
A lot of them, and some of them, came home because they had been hurt for different reasons. And a lot of these guys that came home were outraged by this, and they understood the need for labor, but they still resented the very presence of the Germans on American soil being treated well.
Better than they were living out fighting in Europe. That's, geez Louise. Okay, so without giving too much away, because people really should read the book, there's so much information in there, and you lay it out very well, this whole story. Can you give us a little taste of who Jaworski is and what he was doing?
Leon Jaworski, some of the listeners may recognize, of a certain age, may recognize the name as the special prosecutor who ultimately helped get the White House tapes that forced President Richard Nixon out of the White House. But in the 1940s, he was an ambitious lieutenant colonel in the JAG Corps, in the Advocate General's Office, basically an army prosecutor. And he was really good at this. He was not a young man. He had a career as a crackerjack lawyer in the private sector before surprising everybody by joining the army. You know, he wanted to be in the army. He said he felt like he owed it to his country to do it. And he thought he was going to be, you know, on the periphery of it, you know, and his job mainly was prosecuting American soldiers who had committed crimes on the home front. But he was, much to his surprise, he was thrust into prosecuting the Germans who had committed murder and acts of violence in the camps.
And your book goes into some of those things some of those cases that he's investigating. I feel like there's so many layers to this. Like, first of all, it's not well known that there were even Nazi POW camps in America. And there's like this other layer inside that we didn't know, that there was all this drama of Nazis murdering other Nazis because they weren't Nazi enough inside camps. And then like we sent them in there to investigate. Like, there's so many layers to this story that just is going to blow your mind when you read this book. How long did it take you to dig up all these records and put it all together into a book?
Well, it was my idea for this book was sort of interrupted by COVID. So it's sort of an artificial period. But I first learned about this. I knew absolutely nothing about these camps until 2018. Nothing. I'd never heard that we had any German POW camps. And one day I was returning a book to my local library, and there's a new historical marker planted in front of the library, which is just a couple miles from the house I've lived in for 20 years. And it said, this place in this library, which I've been to hundreds of times, was in World War II, was on the grounds of a German POW camp that had 6,000 German prisoners there. And that this camp was one of, you know, hundreds of these things all across the United States. And I was just stunned by this. So I went home, and there was nothing about it in the library, no books about it. So I went home and went on the internet and just got into a rabbit hole and just found all this information about it. And it just, to answer your question, I just sort of slowly, you know, I went to the National Archives and started doing that. And but this took me, I'd say, maybe 5 years of research. I traveled all around the country going to different, you know, museums and archives and different places to get this information. And it was, and I, not until I was well into the research did I even realize I was interested initially in writing a story about the murders by Germans of other Germans in the POW camps and how we dealt with them. And not until I was well into the research did I realize that the Germans had responded to what we were doing by rounding up a bunch of American POWs and sentencing them to death and offering a trade. So that came pretty late embarrassingly late, honestly, in the process. So it's, I'd say, 5 years of research.
Wow, that's quite a lot. That I can see how COVID would interrupt going around all these different places for sure. I feel like COVID just messed with everybody's timeline on everything.
I wanted to go to the archives right after I got the contract for the book. I was like, okay, I'm going to head right to the National Archives. But there was, COVID had abated by then, that it reopened. But there was such a backlog for researchers that it would have been months before I could get in there. So I went to California, where there was at the UC Davis, where an ex-guard at Fort Leavenworth who had taken an interest in this, had gone to the archives and basically reproduced huge masses of material. And the guard's personal papers were at UC Davis. So I did some other things in California while I was there, you know, went to Stanford the COVID really had an impact on my schedule for working on this.
Well, I really appreciate you putting all this effort into this book. I was just as shocked as you to learn about all of this stuff. So I wanted to ask, that kind of reminds me of all these murders are happening, all this stuff's going down. During that time in World War II, did the newspapers print a lot about this? Was it a scandal at all nationally? All these murders?
No, it was the army which ran the camps, and the U.S. government in general didn't really, the camps were, as I mentioned, they were not exactly a secret, but the government really wasn't that keen to have people know exactly how many of these guys were here, much less that the hardcore Nazis in the camp were murdering the fellow prisoners who turned away from Nazism. So they released very little information about this. And so there wasn't much information out there about the violence that was taking place. And honestly, the American people at the time were really focused on the war, which was, there was things happening every day overseas, you know, not just in Europe and North Africa, but in the Pacific. And a lot of most families had either a loved one or a friend or somebody that was over in the combat zone. So that most of the newspapers were full of goings on at the local POW camp, but, you know, the offensives and, you know, great battles and which local people were being sent overseas or promoted or being wounded or killed or missing. So it was really the POW camps, even though they were in the midst of the United States, were not really something that most Americans were focused on at all, because the war was just the center of everyone's attention.
I have one last question before we go. So we're talking about a little bit about how at first the U.S. didn't separate fervent Nazi ideologues from the Germans that were just kind of like there and part of the party, but weren't very loyal. They didn't separate them. And you lay out really well how the majority of the German POWs were not really ideologues. They were just fighting for their country. And I wanted to ask if some of the more fervent people kind of settled down a little bit, like were influenced by the others, or did the idea spread more and people were more angry that they were captured, or how did the Nazi ideology go in the camps?
I think that it's a tough question to answer, but a lot of the real hardcore Nazis, the ones who had, you know, grown up in the Hitler Youth and were just had totally bought into Hitler's plans and the Third Reich, a lot of them never really did come around. But their influence as the war went on kept getting diluted, because the first wave of German POWs that we had over here mainly from the Africa Corps were largely dedicated Nazis, were at least lukewarm Nazis. But as the war went on, more and more of the prisoners we got had experienced, the Germans had experienced defeat after defeat. They knew they were losing the war, and they had begun to think not about, goals of the Third Reich, but what is going to happen to me after we lose the war? So the dynamic in the camps kept changing, and the Nazis gradually were losing the influence they had in the camps at the beginning of the war, and they were struggling to cling to it and using intimidation and violence and all sorts of other methods, the same methods they used in Nazi Germany to try to keep everybody in line. And that was the dynamic that led to the violence and the killings.
Wow. Well, okay. Is there anything else that you're interested in writing that we can see from you in the future? Any other things you have your sights on?
No, somebody asked me that the other day. That's when you write a book, and that's the first question people ask. I've got a few ideas, but nothing I've developed enough to go into at this point. And I'm really just trying to get this one out and go on the book of events and everything. So I'll take that up a little bit later. I have a couple ideas, but I'm still not sure. I haven't really looked into them enough to know if I want to pursue them, and if the material, the kind of material I want is there. That's not a very good answer to your question, but...
No, that's interesting, though. I can understand that point of view. You don't know until you start, until you focus on one. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions. I really highly recommend anybody interested in World War II to read this book.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice talking with you, and I've enjoyed it.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.